Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. It's like coffee with an analyst, or it could be whiskey with an analyst reading a spreadsheet, linking crime events, identifying a series, and getting the latest scoop on association news and training. So please don't beat that analyst and join us as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Elder, and today our guest has 20 years of law enforcement analysis experience. He was the 2018 Houston Police Department Civilian Technical Employee of the Year. Got great technical expertise, and he's even a book reviewer. He's a New Orleans native representing the great city of Houston, Texas. Please welcome Barry Fosberg. Barry, how we doing?
Just fine. How's it going? I don't even know where you're calling from.
I am calling from Tallahassee, Florida.
Oh, okay. That's where my mom went to school. She was originally from Pensacola.
Talking Florida State?
Yep.
Yes. So it was probably an all-women's school then when she went there, right?
I doubt if that was her favorite part.
So you're a New Orleans native, and I know you're actually planning this week to go back to New Orleans. So what are you looking forward to when you go back to New Orleans this week?
Well, there's kind of two parts to it. That's home for both the wife and myself. Most of my family's kind of scattered in the last 10 years or so, but she still has family and friends there. And just to be straight up honest with you, we both like the food in New Orleans.
Nice.
Pretty much better than anybody else.
So is there a particular restaurant or a particular food you're looking forward to?
Well, obviously seafood. Mm-hmm. And I could probably do about a 20-minute lecture about why New Orleans is Creole and not Cajun.
Okay.
But we like a lot of the Creole classics. But the cool thing about New Orleans is there are these neat neighborhood hole-in-the-wall places mm-hmm. that have stood up over time against the franchises. You know, you just don't have to lay out big bucks to get a decent fee.
All right. Well, let's get started then. How did you discover the law enforcement analysis profession?
I'm not sure that I ever wasn't aware of it. This is something we hadn't talked about. My father was a psychologist, and one of the things he introduced in New Orleans was psychological testing for candidate police officers. I guess you might say I have a bend towards the uniform. I started off going Navy. It was a convoluted route, but after Navy, I spent some time as an admin analyst in New Orleans, shifted out of that line of work because it didn't pay very well in those days. And then when Katrina came, I was working for the local school board, knowing that job was going to go away. I flogged resumes around and I found out there was such a thing as a crime analyst like the day before I interviewed for the job.
So then what is your perspective on Katrina as you think back?
Truth is, our experience was like a lot of people's, but very different. We knew about 2 days after that our home had been totaled.
Oh.
And so we spent about 3 to 4 weeks in different places, either hotels, staying with friends. I had planned for Katrina. I had packed 5 pairs of underwear, so I was good.
That's all it takes.
That's all it takes.
That's all you need.
We were going to be back within a couple of days. Well,
yeah.
5 weeks later, the wife was working with NOPD. She got called back. The city technically was not open yet. Well, skipping a couple of steps, I went back in with her. I volunteered to work at a FEMA camp where we were providing support to firefighters. And these were firefighters at that time, mostly from New York and I want to say Chicago. The result of spending about 2 months this FEMA camp, at one point living out of tents, was I was just surrounded by people who were just very, very up. They had stopped their lives to come to my house, to my city, to make it a better place. And it was like 2 solid months of very positive therapy.
Mm.
So while most people just really had nothing but really bad things to talk about, I found myself in a very positive, very supportive environment. And yeah, we had to, you know, scrape the mud out and throw out literally tons of stuff. But community I was in was just so supportive. And not to me personally, that was their general view of the world. And you couldn't help but pick that up.
That had to be tough. And then not only that, did you, you know, you're starting over, you decide to leave your hometown, your home city, and head to Houston. So you were truly starting over.
Well, the fun part of that really was my wife didn't retire from NOPD for another 8 years. So we were running two households, you know, an hour apart by plane for 8 years.
And what was her position with the NOPD?
At that time, she was grants director.
Oh, okay. And so it would be 8 years then before you were living in the same household. So yeah, that is a whole other level of complication. Is not only you're starting over, but you're running two different households. And so, man. All right. Well, let's talk about you starting as an analyst then, because it's brand new to you. It was, when you think back and you're walking in to Houston PD for the first couple of times there, the first couple of weeks, what do you think about?
Well, in terms of the job, there's some very positive things I can say. Throughout my time, pretty much as a subordinate anywhere, I've had a lot of good employers. So the supervision at the division at that time, I had a sergeant and a lieutenant who had long since decided they had all of the rank they were ever going to have. But the silliness came up. I hate to think of all of the crime analysts out there who spend their lives doing the same report over and over and the same emergency reports. If you've got a sergeant and a lieutenant who know how to say no to folks with stars on their shoulders, that just makes life so much easier. The other thing is from the very beginning, I was very aggressive about going for training. They gave me books to read. I read them. I went online. I found out about IACA. I found out about Alpha Group. I made a point of getting all of the training they would give me. Again, there's a lot of analysts out there. They hear training, travel. If you got good people backing you up, good things can happen. And you can't help but give them good stuff back.
So as you're first starting out and you're going to training, you're reading books, you're getting acclimated to the job, are you relying more on your technical skills and trying to improve the data? Or what was your main focus in the beginning?
Well, I regarded a lot of that stuff as toys. A lot of that was fun to play with. I think I'd stumbled around the world doing a lot of different things and then stumbled in what I should have been doing. So a lot of it just felt like a natural match. I will say that we have a lot of analysts within the department. We have a good mix of people in the division from day one to today who belonged in the world of analysis. And when I came up with things that I thought was cute, I could take them to either a serving officer and they'd try to explain to me that, yeah, that's a good idea, but if you're going to talk to patrol, you need to talk this way. You quickly kind of learn. For example, we had a PhD physicist working for us, and he could handle the technical and the upper end math stuff to a T. And you just figure out who were the people who were best at the thing you were trying to fix. And then kind of the real eye-opener, and I know you recently did a radio broadcast on that, the so what analyst. As a very new, very junior crime analyst, I had to make a presentation to one of our chiefs. And he taught me the single most important expression in crime analysis, so what? I do to this day still enjoy my job. But one of the secrets is if you have good people around you and you know which of them are best at the thing you're not good at, life gets so much easier in that world.
And that's Shauna Gibson from Bellevue, Washington, was the so what analyst.
Yeah, well, that was spot on.
You talked about you have to speak a certain way to patrol, so you had to speak patrolese, right? So was there some tips that you were given on how to speak to patrol?
Well, speaking to one of my lifelong weaknesses, patrol is very goal-oriented. What do I need to know? You know, all of that theory and all of that background, what do I need to know when I hit the street tomorrow or today or whatever? Just keep it simple. And that's not a native skill for me, nor has it become a native skill. So that was kind of number one. And one of the things that's changed is really on the uniform side. My first IACA conference was in New Orleans. It was the first IACA in New Orleans after Katrina. And there had to have been about three presentations about getting respect from the uniforms, getting them to listen to you, a lot of people just having that frustration. What I'm finding out now is, A, it's especially among the rank, they all have degrees, so they can't pretend to not know what a standard deviation is. They may not want to admit it, but they know. They also have it in their promotion exams. And if you'll allow me to kind of go into one of my stories, I knew crime analysis had made it. The wife and I watched NCIS and have for years. And there was this one segment where Leroy Gibbs himself storms into the patrol room area there. And he announces to everyone, we've got to get this perpetrator, no special agents and no crime analysts go home until we do.
Nice.
So they're starting to listen to us. They know who we are.
So where are you stationed at Houston PD, at least in the beginning? Is because obviously Houston is ginormous.
Okay. From day one, I've been in the Crime Analysis and Command Center Division, and it's very important to me that's on the 19th floor because I like to tell people that everything I know about being a policeman, I learned on television, and my view of crime in Houston is from the 19th floor.
I gotcha.
So, you know, I know a lot about what the numbers look like, but somebody's got to remind me that there's real human beings out there and it's just numbers to me, but there's human beings connected to them.
Let's get into some stories. This brings us to your analyst badge story. So I'm looking for your career defining case or project that you have. With yours, you were talking to me about an ex-con murder.
Well, first off, let's understand. If there's anybody in the room who knows the real story, I'm sticking with my version.
Wouldn't have it any other way, Barry.
Exactly. What had happened is a prisoner was released, came to Houston, as many of them do. 3 days later, he washed up dead on the beaches of Galveston. So the question is what do we know about this guy? And one of the ideas I had was to see who are the people that he was known to hang out with, who were his co-defendants, who were the people he'd been seeing in one place or another. And I worked up a list of about, three or four people that very likely he contacted. And this was not a huge thing. It was just scanning the records to see who he hang out with. Well, it was basic police work that rolled up the perpetrators. They tracked down the car. So it wasn't anything I said. They weren't at home. But my version is the officers had a better idea of who was going to be on the other side of the door and what to expect when they made the bust. And that's my story, and I've stuck with it since.
So then what were you able to really find out?
The aspect that kind of rolled forward in several different iterations was that if you bang on the data, if you take the cases and rub them together, you can actually work backwards. And who are the guys who were arrested with him? Who are the guys who were with him when he made complaints? You know, you start building, and nowadays we have software that does this sort of thing. But just looking at the arrest records and the complaint records, you can start building link charts. And my original ones weren't store-bought. It was strictly dig through the data and let the data talk to you.
So let's start with what was the story behind this? Why was this ex-con murdered?
I'm not entirely sure, but I'm going to leave it at that. I don't really know what the motives were once the case was over. I was back to whatever I was back to.
Okay.
A lot of times you don't get good feedback. And I'm kind of particular about once you know something, you're responsible for knowing it. And you kind of learn that in the military. There's the right to know and the need to know.
Yeah, that's the intelligence world, too. So I certainly understand that. When you look back at this case, how would you sum up what the data told you?
Well, as I've kind of indicated, this guy, people don't work alone. Mm-hmm. And it didn't teach me, but it made me think about the fact that, for example, when you arrest somebody, you have one relationship with them. And since they're probably a bad person to begin with, they may not be terribly forthcoming about their address and their phone number. But when they're the victim and somebody broke into their car or trampled on their rights, they want to make sure you have things like the right address and the right phone number. So it's not enough to look at somebody in their criminal life. Mm-hmm. You need to be, and again, the link charts do a lot of this for you, but you need to be flexible enough to say, what else is this person besides either a complainant or a suspect? They could swap roles just as easily.
You have developed a couple of different products over the years. You know, one is the scoring system to rank suspects.
Well, one of the things that I learned, and I may get to this in another segment later, is to periodically ask yourself, what's something you could be doing different? What's something you could be doing creative? And a lot of that is, what did you learn at the last conference? What did you learn scanning over the last paper? But we actually were asked to come up with a pointing system. To my discredit, I did not go straight to IACA and see what they had on file. To my credit, after I did develop it, lo and behold, Chris Bruce had worked one out, and there's a beautiful one-hour video at the IACA website of him explaining the thoughts behind his. And it seems we both asked the same questions about how recently have we seen this guy? How often have we seen him? Have we seen him in major offenses and drug offenses? Has anybody been... Well, actually, the one thing I added that Chris Bruce didn't have is I asked if any non-suspects had been injured in any of these incidents. And I couldn't always prove that they were who they were injured by. But if it was a violent crime and somebody got hurt, that automatically to me meant that person should get a higher priority. Okay. So we ran with that. And I actually got some feedback that somebody we had highlighted got rolled up. Once again, you don't always get a lot of feedback. What we did hear from the DA's office is, and you hear this from DAs all over the country, when you get to a judge, you have to give them a very brief summary that you're willing to stand behind. And as the DA, you need to be able to talk to somebody to confirm the details of what you're about to tell the judge. So where this thing kind of runs up on a shore is it's a great tool to give to officers. But if you're going to try to use it to keep repeat offenders that you've just arrested from going back out on the street, our DA told us you needed somebody available to speak to that particular person at almost any hour of the day or night. And point systems are great, but we never got across that hurdle.
I'm guessing the rest of it was probably pretty standard in terms of the point system, you know, number of times arrested, number of times that they were victims.
The subtle part, and Bruce speaks to this, his math was slightly more precise than math. If somebody did something fairly egregious 5 years ago, and 3 years he was behind bars, and the 2 years he's been back, he's learned his lesson, you don't want to keep putting a highlight on this one guy. So you do want to have a system for saying, I'm aware of him, but he's not as current. There's something about that vote that kind of pushes him back in the pack. And again, in terms of if you read the literature of these point systems, you want to make sure you're not over-identifying one person for the same reasons. So one of the things I looked at is if they were a gang member, if they were on probation, on parole. And I asked myself, am I picking the same people when I have these kinds of criteria? Well, clearly the gangbangers get arrested with some frequency, at least we hope so. But the ones who are on several paroles and several probations, that was a pretty elite group. And you couldn't say you were over-identifying if you were only talking about maybe 2 or 3% of your total numbers. So again, to me, there's numbers, there's people on the other end, and you've got to be sensitive to the fact that if you're in the wrong neighborhood, you can get arrested for being in the wrong neighborhood. And I don't want to put a spotlight on somebody like that.
So it sounds like you're building a program that is twofold. The first part of it is crunching the numbers, doing counts of all these different variables that are of interest to identifying key offenders. But you also talk about a qualitative component to this, where there's a human aspect of reviewing the list and making decisions about whether to move up or move down the suspect based on the individual themselves.
I kind of made a point of never, if the numbers put somebody first, they were first, period. Mm-hmm. I did not want any subjective aspect to it at all, but I did want to quality check my inputs. If, you know, when you put numbers in a number machine, you get numbers back. As an analyst, it's your job to understand what your numbers are trying to tell you. And a lot of times that's very, very difficult. I don't think anybody gets that more than so many times out of 100, but I wanted to be very conscious about, if my top 10 are going to be the top 10 no matter what I do, then why have all those variables? But if there's something in those variables that distinguish 5 from 6 and 7 from 9, that makes that number valid. If you're just putting score on top of score, to me, that's not acceptable.
So then how does the scoring system work then? And certainly you could go into this in great detail, but I just give the audience just a little bit of idea in terms of how the score is calculated.
Well, certain things were one point, just up front. At some point, this is arbitrary. Some points are degraded by age. So now you've got fractional points. I haven't touched this in several years, so I'm going to try to speak at a higher level at the beans and bullets, the individual gears. So that some things were arbitrary, but there's another theory in this whole process of social harm. And what that says, and the way I read it was, at one point I went to an officer and I said to the officer, based on your knowledge of the system, how would you rank these different types of offenses? And by the way, I didn't even go into sight blocking and all of that stuff. It had to be a pretty severe crime for it to even show up on the list. So I started with, as an officer, how would you compare these types of charges? Well, later I read about social harm. And what social harm says is, within your state, there is a relatively objective approach, which is to look at what the penalties are. If the penalty for grand theft or felony theft, however your state refers to it, is 6 months, and the penalty for aggravated assault is 2 years, you've just been told how to rank these two. Your state is of the opinion that one is four times more harmful than the other. And again, that was something I tried to bring into the scoring system. Now, for me, a probation was a probation. A parole was a parole. It was very hard for me to qualify which of these was senior to the others. And it was quite embarrassing to find out that there were a very tiny number of people who ran up very high scores under those. I always thought, you know, I know police work from TV. If you violate probation, you're supposed to go behind bars. So how can you be on multiple probation?
Double secret.
It's not that way on TV, so that can't be the truth.
All right. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about some of the points that you want to discuss on ethics, and certainly want to get some of your advice for our listeners. And then we'll finish up with personal interest, talking about you as a book reviewer.
Okay, let's do that.
You're listening to Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Dawn Reby, 22 plus years in law enforcement analytics and CEO of Excellence in Analytics. And here's our public service announcement of the day. Hire a qualified coach. The process of growth and development is not easy. And quite honestly, many professionals in service-based industries have their wheels spinning for years. It just doesn't work. It doesn't get better. You can only see through your lenses. Hiring a coach is the best thing that I did years ago, and I still have one today. I love the clients we coach. They get results, and those results are real. They build confidence, they create better work-life harmony, they excel in their careers, and they simply have more joy. It is possible. Get yourself there faster by hiring a qualified coach.
Hey, this is Freddie Croft, Lieutenant with HPD. My public service announcement is to encourage people to get a T model of skill acquisition. Learn a broad set of skills across many different things, and then find one that interests you and dive deep into that. Learn and become a subject matter expert in it. Doing that will allow you to be extremely successful in your career.
Welcome back. Barry, before I get into the ethics portion, during the break, we were talking about the offenders list that you had developed, that program, and that was more of a offender base project that you work. But recently, you've been spending most of your time on place-based efforts. So let's just quickly talk about that before we move on to ethics.
Yeah, well, you were talking about how I got started. One of the things, I timed it right. We were in a very early version of ARC map when I first got there, and it was such a bear, no one wanted to play with it. And about the time I got interested in mapping, Esri rolled out a much, much better product, and things got a lot easier. Well, of the different things you can do in the world of law enforcement, in the last several years, I've been really concentrating more on the mapping side, the business of policing places. And I'm really hungry to try some RTM stuff, Professor Kaplan. But we decided to produce for both leadership and patrol a series of microzone maps. And we divided, to give you an idea how big Houston is, we divided her up into over 200,000 1 million square foot hexagons. And what we find over and over again is, yes, crime can happen everywhere, but mostly it doesn't. Mm-hmm. You remember the 80-20 rule is...
Yeah, Pareto's principle.
Right, and now it's the 660 rule. Well, you can get a vast percentage of your crime accounted for in anywhere from 2 to 10% of your city. Mm-hmm. And when you chop it up into small pieces, you realize that's a very small area. So we had worked out, and we've been doing this now for 2 years, we were dividing the city up into microzones and saying where was the most stuff happening per shift. Again, patrol is kind of oriented towards shifts, so I wanted to give them that kind of product. And I've also felt that as the profession has moved away from the large density maps to microzones, what you're really saying is there are certain addresses that are really driving your numbers. So I always published addresses and microzones. Well, we now have Jim Mallard, and we're darn lucky to have him. He's got a slightly different viewpoint, which is that microzones are fine except for two things. The entire microzone isn't the hotspot, and they don't relate to anything that patrol really understands. So when you dispatch a patrol officer to, you know, MB-123, they'll find it on a map, but it doesn't really mean anything to them. Plus, if they're on this side of the microzone, but the real trouble is on the other, well, Jim said, to heck with that, let's focus on street lengths. Now, street lengths and me go back a long way, and it's not all a pretty picture, so I'm going to skip some steps.
Okay.
And say that a lot of the things I was concerned about in Houston, we've got very, very, very large street lengths and very, very small. But if you look for the street lengths that have the most incidents reported there, they're not typically 5 miles of highway, nor are they, and 5 miles is an exaggeration, nor are they typically 3/100,000 of a foot, which is, oddly enough, not an exaggeration. So if you just let the data lead, you'll find that there are streets that are way overreported. Mm-hmm. And if you're off, you're off by a matter of, you know, the width of the street or the building behind it or some rational distance. And oh, by the way, how do most police officers deal with the city? They deal with the city as streets. Hmm. So that's a much, I think that tool is going to resonate with a little bit more accuracy, but with a lot more meaning to the officer. And in the meantime, we actually have a better system for identifying addresses. So we're still giving them that, but it'll be, we think, slightly more accurate information.
Now, how do you keep from them saying, well, I know that already, right? Because, I mean, if you're just talking about certain streets that are popular, and popular in quotes there, using either calls for service or arrest data or whatever it is, I mean, somebody that's doing that on each shift is going to say, well, yeah, I'm there every day. I know that street is hot. Tell me something I don't know.
Yeah, this is kind of the all-time classic. The way I always explain it is the officer looks at that, looks at me and says, who do you think wrote all those reports? And I'm not sure that we can completely get away from it. My excuse is being on the 19th floor. My audience is principally decision makers. Mm-hmm. And they don't always know. And it becomes a very useful tool for them to take to their, you know, there's different levels of senior people. And they now have a common language of here's a map that puts a number on everything I've been trying to tell you. Now, there is some debate in the literature, and this is where being a crime analyst, you're supposed to stand between what the academics are saying and the officer who says, I wrote those reports. And that's, there is some reason to believe that, well, you know, that again, the cheap out is officers move around. So you do always have the one who's new to that patrol area. But they also have a tendency to have long memories. So they may remember the hotspot bar that got shut down a month ago. Or they may remember the apartment complex that just changed management and is now cooperating more with law enforcement to clean up. So you do have some of these on the edges type things where every now and then they'll go, if you don't know this intersection and that intersection, you better not go out at night because you're not safe. But they'll always be the one where, oh, I hadn't thought about that, or I was so focused on this one. Or if I can quote Jim Mallard again, how often do you as an officer or a decision maker have to respond to the same area before you stop thinking of it as a one-off? Mm-hmm. When does that area go from being a tactical problem that you can handle normal day-to-day shift to something that's got to be kicked up to a higher level of attention? And I think mapping this stuff helps provide some of that data to the people, to the other analysts out in the divisions who can look at it, or the officer who says, I keep looking here, I keep forgetting to look there.
I like it. And we could certainly talk about that more and more, but I do want to move on to ethics because I am excited to hear about Fossberg's first law of bureaucracy.
Okay. Fossberg's first law of bureaucracy is that data is slippery, numbers are in concrete. And a whole lot of what kind of ground level crime analysis is how do you type this? Who do you associate that with? And as much as I can kind of avoid being subjective, and I'll give the example of an officer who retired a few years ago, she used to track day for day home invasions. Well, there is no law that says for something to be a home invasion, these are the minimum standards. So she literally sat there day for day and had to make decisions about, is it a home invasion if they intercepted the guy in the apartment parking lot and then forced him into his apartment, and all these other variations? And to summarize the point, eventually it's your job to call it. Now, you know in your head how arbitrary that call is, but as soon as you put that number on it, somebody out there is going to be defending either that number is right or you're lying to them. And that, to me, is kind of the entry to all of this. There's a lot of times where your supervisor wants a report that says COVID caused crime to go up. I think there's a lot of justification to that. But here's the thing. A lot of crime categories had already started going up November and December before any of us were talking about COVID. So yeah, you could tell your supervisor, blame it on COVID and we can go home. And that may be all your supervisors. Remember, we're staff, they're executive. They've got to call it, but you have to be able to live with the advice you gave. And I'm going to cite one other. I got to thinking about this for a long time, but I went to a presentation at IACA, I want to say in Washington. And one of the speakers was a lawyer talking specifically to ethics. And his bottom line, which I'm going to make mine unless you have other questions, if you're facing a question today that's raising ethical alarms inside of you, as a lawyer, he was going to promise you that later that year or the next year, somebody was going to be facing that problem in a courtroom. So, you know, ethics can be foggy and whatever, but it's also about, when does that number meet a person? And if you're not applying your numbers properly, somebody's being hurt unreasonably.
It's fascinating because it reminds me of the time that I was working for a police department and somebody from the mayor's office called and they wanted to know what crime was as of 2 a.m. on this one particular date. And We asked them, well, that was kind of odd, like, why would you want it at 2 a.m. on this particular date? And the person kind of hemmed and hawed and didn't really give us an answer. And the one sergeant ended up calling him personally on the phone after the teleconference and trying to get out of him what was going on. And here they were working on trying to get the mayor reelected. And the reason they were picking 2 a.m. on that particular day is that hours before that, there was like 9 shootings in the city. And they wanted to crop out, essentially, those 9 shootings. So when they published the data, it would look better for the mayor.
As I've said, we're staff, they're executive, but we all swim in a very highly politicized field. And I got to tell you, in terms of reading the literature, I'm seeing more and more about stuff that crime analysts just did, and now there's questions coming back from the community. Is what you're doing fair? Does what you do stand up to the question of, yeah, the numbers are what the numbers are, but there's a human being there too. Yeah. And I know I need to have it by this afternoon and it's already 2 o'clock. If you're a crime analyst and you haven't had one of those yet, don't admit it to anyone.
All right. Well, let's move on then. You've been around for a while now. What are you surprised that law enforcement and analyst profession hasn't figured out yet? I mean, this is something that when you first started, you'd be like, oh, we would figure this out by 2021.
Well, I have two answers to that, but I'm going to go to the one that kind of challenged me personally, and it's why I tried to develop things. We sit on vast amounts of data, and the commercial world, I mean, Amazon 5-6 years ago put in a patent for a set of mathematical tools that would predict the next thing you were going to buy. I mean, if we can get data to talk that well, the whole business of predictive analytics within law enforcement, maybe we shouldn't be quite that far along, but we should be a lot further along. I'm trying to decide which of two directions I want to go. To just summarize on data, it very much bothers me that so many police departments, mine included, don't have regular database-to-database access to our neighbors. You know, we have people like Christina Whitehead, who just did a magnificent job getting a regional crime analysis association going in the Houston area. And they do great work backing each other up case for case. But you cross the line and all of a sudden your database is zero. Mm-hmm. And that shouldn't be happening. It bothers me that there's too many departments like that. The other thing, and this is one that I see some breakthrough, but constantly crime analysts are asking each other, what is the good analyst software out there? You know, there's and with a department as big as ours, if you can't get my commander to buy your stuff, you go to another commander and he may have his pot of money. And you know, there's no repository, there's no clearinghouse. And I understand there's, you know, legal issues and exposure and all of that, but we need a consumer affairs for crime analysis vendor provided products.
That's an interesting concept. Yeah.
I think I gave you three answers.
Yeah, but that's okay. And then there's a lot of food for thought there. And I the last one, the consumer advocate, that's an interesting concept, especially with dealing with vendors. Because and it makes me think about my time in Cincinnati. I advocated and the police department bought the Bear software at the time. And I used it, but I never really felt that it was truly implemented and to be part of standard operating procedure. And so I felt that analysts just used it if they thought about using it and never really integrated it into the process.
I always told my supervisors, don't let me have the checkbook because I'll buy everything twice. I also said that my personal philosophy was I don't want to buy things unless I know I've exhausted the capabilities of what we have. And so, for example, on the back burner, I've always wanted to do not only an RTM type project, but if you go back to the crime analysis and what is it, 60 steps that Pop Center puts out.
John Eck, yes.
Yeah, John Eck, Pop Center. One of the things they have in there is about crime attractors, and I forget now what the whole typology is. But you can do the math straight out of take your pick, Access, Excel. There's nothing that elaborate about it. You take the information you already have. And I'll be honest, I did try it once, but I forgot the part where you're supposed to be able to say why the numbers are what they are. And when you get a result that says this is a crime attractor, as a crime analyst, it's your job to say, oh, there's a big shopping center here, and that's attracting shoplifters. Well, duh, but I hadn't done that step. I had just done the math, and my model wasn't quite right, and I've never been able to get back to it. But bottom line is, you don't need to buy software to do that.
Yeah, it was Eck and Clark that did those 60 steps.
Good stuff still in there.
Oh, yeah, it's a classic. You mentioned, you know, if you were in charge, you would buy everything twice. So that was one of the questions I wanted to ask you is, in terms of data, I wanted to put you in a what-if scenario. You have been made the data czar of the police department. And I was curious to know, as data czar, what were some things that you would do to resolve some issues with the data?
Well, the good news is HPD does have a section within planning called data governance. Mm-hmm. So the good news is I don't have to have solutions. That's what they do. One of the ongoing issues, and I think it's pretty universal, and it's siloed data. And there's sometimes it's siloed because a particular analyst doesn't like what they're getting, so they replace it with their own. And sometimes there's security issues. You know, the gang data, you probably don't want that flogged all over the universe. But as a crime analyst, I have to take the same CJIS tests everyone else does. I can be put in jail for leaking data just as quickly as anyone else. We live on data and we have to have access to it. And it has to be available to anybody who can figure out how to use it, you know, within the provisos of CJIS and, you know, shared vulnerability. So we have too many data silos, and I think that's kind of a universal. The next step up from that to me is crossing jurisdiction lines. I've already talked about that. The baddies cross jurisdiction lines, our data has to follow. And then the last thing, kind of, since I've already hit that point, I don't need to drill on it too much, is we also have to do a better job of talking to each other. I mentioned Krista, I mentioned Galea, the Greater Houston Crime Analysis. There's also the group doing that have revived the statewide association. But in a giant department like ours, analysts come, analysts go. I would very much like to get everybody together on a regular basis and let them know what's in the data and have them tell me what they're using it for. Because the other aspect of being large and being diverse is we've got centers of excellence all over this department who are solving very interesting problems, but they're only solving it within their boundaries.
So how would you get past the taking down the walls across boundaries? Because you couldn't do this nationwide, but my first thought would be, you know, a state could require that all the jurisdictions have the ability to share data. And that would get into all the various vendors and the RMS systems then would all have to communicate. And that would be obviously a huge mess, but it would still be something that would be beneficial to really being able to communicate from neighbor to neighbor.
Well, first off, I have been to at least two presentations, and I'm aware of a third vendor software where virtually, well, I'm going to say it was like 80 or more agencies were feeding each other data. And I'm sorry, I don't remember the state. Mm-hmm. Missouri comes to mind, but that's from a presentation many years ago. But they did have a common data exchange, and that included DA's office and the judge's office and some of the prisons and jurisdictions. So there are some folks who have found a common platform for exchanging data. The Navy for a while, and I just lost track of it, they had a links program. And why it was the Navy, I don't know. But it was, again, an opportunity for jurisdictions to trade information. And it kind of came down to some jurisdictions were putting stuff up there. Other jurisdictions, you had to talk to one person by name, assuming they were at work that day, and assuming your priority were the same as theirs. So there's all of these lines are out there. How would I'm data czar. I'm just going to say I'm data czar. Do it.
There you go.
In terms of the engineering, I'm really grasping here. But things like Java and PDF were invented to cross platforms. Java and PDF is what, 30, 40 years old now?
Yes.
I'm imagining there's other things that cross platforms.
Oh, sure. If you build the connection and do it, it's certainly capable. You would just have to force them to do it, right? And what have a standard operating procedure on what data will be shared and what won't be shared.
That's
rules of the game.
NCIC has done that for how long? I forget. NCIC has been around. I'm calling it NCIC. Yeah, the National.
Yeah.
Do I have the right initials there?
Yeah, you do. The National Criminal Information System.
That's
what we're going with for now.
Yeah, well, that's how we'll translate. So there's bits and pieces of it around. Some guys just don't like to share. Look how long it took to get us to get to NIBRS. And I'm not sure that everybody's there yet, even with state and federal law.
Yeah, you just made a bunch of people wrinkle their nose by bringing up NIBRS.
I'm not sure that I'm entirely inoculated against it either. I understand why the potential is there, but the execution still gives me the willies. And I don't think the patrol officers like it that much.
Oh, yeah, that's for sure. All right. Well, I'm going to move on then. What advice do you have for experienced analysts?
Well, the first thing I would say to them is keep learning. I'll be honest with you, Jim Mallard and I, as he was leaving for the day, were joking about the adaptability of certain people who were having gray beard like I do and sit in an office like I do, not always being adaptable to the newest ideas. But fundamentally, as a crime analyst, you are a professional. As a professional, it's part of your job to keep learning. Now, the other piece to that is, why are you learning? You are the area expert. When different people come into the room, you expect the police officers to know the most about what the rules are for when you can arrest people and how you can arrest people. You expect the robbery investigators to know the most about what the different robbery suspects and MOs look like. But when they turn to you as the crime analyst, you can't just be, oh, well, I'll give you next week's report next week. You are the area expert. You're supposed to be able to speak to, when they give you the time, what the theories are, but you should be able to understand how that theory might apply as an action item within your unit. And when they come to you and say, oh, I just want a chart that says this and this, you're the expert. You need to be able to lead. Well, you need to know who you're talking to, because sometimes they want what they want, and that's all they're going to accept. But it's on you to show the leadership to say, well, that'll do what you need it to do, but wouldn't this be better? And that's where no one should know more about crime analysis as it applies to your unit than you as a senior crime analyst.
Good advice. The one thing we haven't mentioned that we talked about in the prep call was having the analytical mind. You know, we talked a little bit about the hiring process, hiring for analysts, and you're really looking for identifying those that are going to have an analyst mind. So go through your philosophy on that a little bit.
Where I usually start with this is that, you know, the psychologist will tell you, you aren't your job, you're who you are. And as it happens, psychologists are called psychoanalysts. And I know that because my dad was one. And that's me saying being analytical is part of how you look at the world. Do you take it apart? Do you try to figure out what the logic is behind it and what the rules might be? Or, you know, red's red and green's green, so what? I happen to feel that officers have to have an analytical orientation. If you think about that poor officer out on the street at 2 a.m. in the freezing rain, trying to make sense out of five stories, he's trying to analyze what people are telling him. So kind of fundamental to all of this is, are you comfortable with numbers? Are there certain things you can do in your head where, for example, a list of nine whole numbers should not total up to more than 99? And well, actually, they shouldn't. They should total up to 81. See, so you have to have that thing in the back of your head that goes, that was easy to say, but was it right? So 9 times 9 is 81. I'm trying to figure out how to make this concrete. I used to keep a couple of cartoons that I always wanted to include in a interview. And one was this woman out in the beautiful countryside, and she sees in front of her this lovely sugar loaf-shaped mountain, and she looks at it and smiles, and she sees it as a normal curve. My question was going to be, why would that be funny? Not do you find it funny, but do you understand why it might be? Yeah, and the point is if you look at the world a certain way, yeah, you see beautiful nature, but you see your good old friend, the normal curve. Yeah, the typical interview is, you know, where did you go to school and how many years have you done this? And, you know, do you secretly hate police officers? I don't know. But what I'm listening for is, are they comfortable with numbers? And not only are they comfortable with numbers, do they fundamentally understand that numbers are where you start? You know, when you say aggravated assault went up between January and April, don't they always? In our jurisdiction, they pretty much do. Well, what happened between January and April in 2020? You know, when you go to a signed meeting, do you just take the most obvious thing? Or do you think about, you know, maybe it's because kids are in school or not in school, or the weather's hotter? You know, how far are you willing to go once you found a number?
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about your personal interests. As I mentioned in the intro, you're a book reviewer, and I find that fascinating. First off, how did you get started as being a book reviewer?
Well, I've been a big time book nerd for a very long time.
Well, that makes one of us.
Sorry about that. But when people tell me about vlogs and blogs and all of the rest of that stuff, I'm like, I'm too busy reading. Leave me alone. That's one time when the old man just hasn't made the adaptation. What I found was that whether I'm leaving a book or leaving a movie, I'm basically tearing it down in my head. What worked? What didn't work? I'm applying analysis to the book. Well, somewhere along the line, I got involved with Amazon. I did adopt Amazon, I think, relatively early. And lo and behold, anybody can publish a review. You establish an account. They don't even need spell checker, because I hate to say some of my reviews desperately need spell checker. If you live by spell checker, you die by spell checker. But in the earlier version, you know, everybody has likes and dislikes. Well, they also give you a ranking. So there's a competition aspect to it. And by the way, if you get to be good enough, people try to give you stuff. And I haven't broken into that ring yet, and I don't want to. But it's one thing to think it in your head. It's one thing to write it down. And by the way, the business of writing stuff down can help you be more aware of where you need help writing. And I have learned to remove certain clauses that I over-depend on. And I think that shows up in work, too. I think that's gotten a little crisper. But all of a sudden, you have an audience. I mean, what more can you ask out of life? You can publish for free. No editor to tell you you've got to read this one before you read that one. You know, you get feedback.
With the feedback, then, is it, I'm thinking with in terms of just the Amazon portion of it, I know that there's the essentially the like button, which it says you click on it and said, okay, this comment or this review I found helpful.
Right.
Is that essentially the type of feedback you're getting back?
Well, once upon a time, they had likes and dislikes, and they still give you what your percentage of likes is, which is a little ridiculous because for 3 or 4 years now, the only thing you can get is likes. There used to be a comment section. And not only did they have a comment section, but they also had kind of, I guess you'd call it a social networking side, mm-hmm. where they had forums and so forth. They cleared all of that out. They also bought a company called Goodreads. And for that stuff, I go to Goodreads. And by the way, one of the really neat things I'm now putting in a plug for Goodreads, there you can do buddy reads where it's a group read. It's a reading club.
Oh, I see.
And you get on it when you feel like get on it and post what you feel like posting. And a lot of times stuff I missed, somebody else picked up on. So I can get several dimensions of feedback.
So do you feel that you're an influencer then in that you're doing these book reviews and if you give it a good book review, then, well, Barry likes this book, so I'm going to read this book as well.
Well, the most exact answer is yes, I do have a following and I have influenced a few people.
Just but a few.
An influencer? No. There's folks that I follow who have hundreds of followers, and I'm in some of the groups where I can see what other people are buying and reading. But a lot of what I read is, you know, I get to the bestseller 5 years after it fell off the bestseller list. So there was a book I read. It was actually what happened was it was a religious book. And since I don't remember the name, I'm not going to fake it. I had reviewed an earlier book by this particular author, and his topic was religion. And in fact, I got into a very big back and forth with somebody as to whether I was not sufficiently aware in my review. But right about the time my review came out, the author wrote another book that became very controversial. And it was so controversial that his earlier book suddenly got popular and the number of likes I had skyrocketed. Back in the day, we called that a golden snitch. It was that one review you posted that turned into gold. Okay. I didn't have anything to do with that. The guy became controversial. I just happened to be there with the old book. So I don't think I have a sideline in the future where companies will ask me to review their books and expect me to affect their sales.
So how many books have you reviewed?
With Amazon, I've got, if you'll give me a minute, because I keep track. With Amazon, I think I told you my email includes the digit 61. Mm-hmm. Because that's how many reviews I had, total reviews I had posted at that time. So I'm up to a total of about 1,250.
Wow.
Of those, I'd have to check elsewhere, but about 700 to 800 of them are specifically books. Most of the rest are movies or a category I call stuff.
Now, can people find you on Amazon? Like, if we search Barry Fosberg on Amazon, does it come up with the list of reviews that you've done, the books and your review?
If you're clever, you probably can dox me. I'm trying to think what my Amazon handle is, because, like I say, I review a whole lot of things, some of them not very professional. And I think I'm just going to leave it at that.
Oh, you're not going to allow us to try to find you?
Well, if somebody cares that much, they can. I will give you one hint. I recently read and reviewed all 7 books in the Remembrance of Things Past by Marcel Proust, which is one of the Mount Everest of reading achievements, mostly so I could say I did it. So you might be able to work backwards if you find me that way.
Okay, there we go. I'll challenge.
I'm going to warn people out front that some of it is not appropriate for office.
Now you're making people want to go search and find you, see what you're up to.
If my votes skyrocket, that's fine. If I get called into the office, I'm going to be very angry.
Oh, hopefully not. I don't like to get people into trouble. I think I tell people, I was like, I like to talk about controversy, but I don't like to get anybody into trouble. So,
well, that's it. I've also reviewed some, not enough, but I have reviewed some computer books and some crime analysis books. But I think I'm a few editions behind.
All right, you got to get up to speed.
What was the book you mentioned to me the other day?
Bigger Than Data. Don Reby just published a book. And
I've got to follow up on
about a month ago. I do highly recommend that book to our listeners and to you as well.
I'm writing it down, and that's Bigger Than Data.
All right. Well, our last segment of the show is Words of the World. And this is when I give the guest the last word. Barry, you can promote any idea that you wish. What are your words to the world?
I mentioned this earlier. At one time, I worked for a PR firm in New Orleans run by a woman named Sharon Brilsky. She used to come into the office every now and then, even before saying hello to anyone, and we were off in our different corners. And she would just ask out loud, what could I be doing today to promote this particular cause or this particular account or person? And that just struck me as a really right way to think. I've tried to do that where I'll be sitting in my office and I will deliberately stop what I'm doing and just ask myself, what would be a more creative thing to be doing? What would be a new tool to apply?
Very good. Well, I leave every guest with you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later.
Fair enough.
But I do appreciate you being on the show, Barry. Thank you so much and you be safe.
You too, sir. Same for you. And yours.
Thank you for making it to the end of another episode of Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. You can show your support by sharing this and other episodes found on our website at www.leapodcasts.com. If you have a topic you would like us to cover or have a suggestion for our next guest, please send us an email at leapodcasts@gmail.com. Till next time, analysts, keep talking.